What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, President Trump's attempt to reinstate his 7-country travel ban is unanimously rejected by a United States Court of Appeals. Why did the White House lose this fight? And now what? Then, the search for a young refugee days from being accepted into the United States who was caught up in the ban. And the stories you told us about the moment you realized that history had intersected with your life. It's Friday, February 10th.
Hello?
Adam, it's Michael Barbaro.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
How are you?
I'm all right.
You do not break a sweat.
It's been a long week.
Moments after the Federal Court of Appeals issued its decision on Thursday night, I called Adam Liptak, our Supreme Court reporter. So I think we're just going to jump right in. You're on deadline.
Yeah.
Adam, why did the Trump White House lose this case?
They made some very broad claims. They went into the Ninth Circuit and said that their national security determinations in the area of immigration are unreviewable by courts, and they don't have to submit any evidence to make the case that they could precipitously and fairly radically revise the nation's immigration policies. And the court was having none of that. It said judges in a constitutional democracy have a role to play to make sure the Constitution is applied. And it said that the people whose lives were disrupted by the travel ban have due process rights that it looks like the executive order violates. The court also spent a little time on it, didn't decide, but it seemed to say there were also quite substantial religious discrimination claims in play here, too. And for now, the court said it was better to freeze the situation in place before the travel ban went into effect.
Let's talk about due process for just a minute. This is the Fifth Amendment, and it guarantees people in the United States a set of kind of legal principles. They're going to be given, and the argument from the court seems to be that this executive order was depriving people of that.
Right. If I have a right to be in the United States, travel to the United States, be in the United States, go out of the United States, come back to the United States, if I have that right, the government has to give me process. It has to explain to me why I'm being barred. It has to give me a chance to contest that. And in shutting the doors precipitously on entire classes of people, the court said, those due process rights were likely violated.
The court document, which I just finished reading, and I'm sure you've read it much more carefully than I did, but the tone was castigating. I mean, it was chastising the Trump White House for shifting interpretations. And I read this, and I don't know if you feel the same way. The judges basically said that they didn't trust the White House to apply this legally.
Michael, I came away with the same feeling, particularly in the passage where, you know, initially the order on its face seems to apply to lawful permanent residents, people holding green cards. Then the White House counsel, Doug McGahn, says, no, we're not going to apply it to lawful permanent residents. And the court says, where does the White House counsel stand in the constitutional hierarchy? Why should we trust him? He's a lawyer for the president in the White House. He's not even in the Justice Department. And what's to tell us that he's not going to decide something different tomorrow?
It was kind of interesting. You almost expected them to be saying in the next line, we want to hear it directly from Donald Trump in this courtroom. And short of that, we don't buy it.
I think that's on the right track. I mean, they certainly wanted for there to be, for instance, evidence. You know, they were frustrated that they had invited the government to explain why it was that these seven nations, who are already subject to fairly substantial vetting, all of a sudden required further vetting, and they got no help from the government. They said they would have welcomed evidence. I don't think they wanted Donald Trump personally to appear in the courtroom, but they wanted someone to treat them as equal partners in the constitutional structure.
In general, it seems like a bad idea to build a case that's being heard by judges on the idea that judges in the judicial system don't have any power, right?
It doesn't seem to me the best play as a litigator. And they themselves say, listen, we understand this. We owe the political branches and the president very substantial deference. They're better at making national security judgments than we are. They have a lot of control over immigration. But to say that the executive actions are unreviewable by the courts, this court suggested, is a dangerous and unconstitutional proposition.
So, Adam, the borders will remain open to immigrants from these seven states for the foreseeable future?
Yes, that's right. I mean, these are people who have already gotten legal authorization to come here. So it's not like someone from Iran can show up at the border and come in. They will have to have obtained a visa previously. It's just that that right can't be taken away from them precipitously without due process.
President Trump responded right after the decision from the Court of Appeals by tweeting, quote, "See you in court. The security of our nation is at stake." So, Adam, what happens next? Where does this case go?
I don't think we have a definitive answer from the administration yet, but I would be shocked if they didn't in short order ask the Supreme Court to overturn this ruling.
And the Supreme Court is now widely viewed as split 4-4 between a traditional left and more right-leaning branch. Where would this case fall? And therefore, and if we can hazard a guess, always dangerous now, what do we think is likely to happen if it gets there?
So I think a 4-4 tie is a fairly likely outcome. The 4-4 tie would leave in place what the appeals court just did. There are other permutations, but it's not obvious to me that the administration is going to find 5 votes on this 8-member court to overturn this ruling.
Okay, Adam, thanks so much, and good luck writing tonight.
You bet. Thanks, guys. Bye.
The weekend that President Trump's immigration ban went into effect, the New York Times published a photo of a boy, a 16-year-old boy from Afghanistan, Sardar Hussein. He's dressed in a blue untucked button-down shirt and a dark gray tie. He's wearing skinny black jeans and Converse sneakers. His hands are in his pockets. He's got a backpack on. And he's standing in front of the rusty gate of the United Nations Office of Refugees in Jakarta. He's looking to the side. It's hard to know exactly what he's thinking. He's just found out, days before he's scheduled to fly to America, that President Trump's immigration ban calls for ending resettlement for refugees like him for at least 4 months. Somehow, you can see all of that in the photo. A lot of us here had seen it, and we all wanted to know what happened to him. So my producer, Lisa Tobin, and I have spent the last 2 weeks trying to find Sardar. We started with a call to Jakarta.
Hello.
Hey, Joe. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Actually, it's evening to you, isn't it?
It is. It's 10 p.m.
Joe Cochran is the reporter who first encountered the boy. I want to talk about Sardar Hussein, and tell me if I'm correctly pronouncing that. Sardar.
It's Sardar, but he goes by the nickname Sammy, and that's what I know him by, and that's how we interact. He's currently 16 years old. When he was 13 and living in Ghazni, Afghanistan, his home province with his family, he, in the course of a few hours of one day, became an orphan. His father and mother and little sister were taking a taxi to Kabul because his mother was ill, and they were taking her to one of the central hospitals in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. And they were killed by a roadside bomb, and instantly Sammy became an orphan. He had no relatives in his home village. He had nowhere to go, so what he did was quite quickly sold off the family's possessions, including like furniture, plates, any pieces of nice jewelry. And he did, as he told me, he did what everyone else, all the Hazaras in his home province were doing, was getting out of Afghanistan. And he managed to put together the equivalent of $7,000 to pay smugglers to get him out of Afghanistan with the ultimate goal of trying to reach Australia.
So he sold all the goods. He made this plan all by himself as an orphan.
He did. And So what he did after he it was quite easy to contact these smuggling networks, and he flew from Afghanistan to New Delhi, and from New Delhi to Kuala Lumpur, and then he got on a boat and was smuggled into Indonesia and found himself stuck here because there were no more refugee boats illegally sailing to Australia because of, they cracked down on that. And then he was able to gain admittance into a refugee shelter for minors.
What is Sammy like?
He's a nice kid. He's very bright. He's very earnest. His English, thanks to his own, you know, hard work, has improved dramatically. He says he's a devout Muslim, and he denounces terrorism. He denounces organizations and terrorist groups that attack anyone around the world. He has a very, very positive outlook on life, and he just wants to go somewhere where he can get back into school because he's missed 3 years of school, and he wants to be resettled with a family so he could sort of be part of that family because he lost his entire family when he was 13.
Of all the countries he could go to, why did he want to go to the United States, and what has he said about America to you?
You know, as part of his original plan, he wanted to get out of Afghanistan and go to a safe nation. And when he learned that he was going to the United States, and he only learned that on January 10th, that he found out where he was going after waiting over 2 years, he said he was absolutely ecstatic. He said he had great respect for the United States, that it was a dream come true.
And legally, he had all the paperwork and all the process exactly where it needed to be at that moment.
Absolutely. He had gone through a thorough vetting process. He had his clearance from the United States Department of Homeland Security. He had, through the International Organization of Migration, his travel plan. He had an airline ticket. He had a ride to the airport.
Got every detail.
Prior to meeting me, he had just completed the final checking of the box for his trip to resettle in the United States. That was a complete physical examination. He went back to have a look at this old neighborhood, looked around at the sidewalk where he slept for 51 nights, and then he went down to the town of Bogor just outside of Jakarta to say goodbye to some other asylum seekers or friends who had achieved refugee status to say goodbye. And then
we want to ensure that we are not admitting into our country the very threats our soldiers are fighting overseas.
Trump signed this executive order
to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here.
Denying entry. And Sammy, who had been waiting here for 2+ years, was that close to getting on an airplane and being resettled in the United States. And at that point, it seemed his hopes were dashed.
I kind of want you to share some of the communications you had in between the time that the executive order came out and now.
Sure. A lot of it was by instant messaging. I said, I'm sorry, this executive order has been signed, and I fear that you're not going to be able to leave Indonesia until this is all cleared up. And his responses were that I have faith, and I have faith that I'm going to reach America one day, and it's God's will what happens to me. I'm confident I'm going to get there eventually. He just seemed to have this firm belief that it was going to happen for him. I sort of felt he was in denial. Hmm. He certainly was in disbelief because he was just 72 hours away from getting on an airplane. So that was through Saturday and Sunday. And then I got a message from him on Monday saying, I'm on the way to the airport. And I go, really? What are you doing? He's like, well, I'm flying to the United States. To go, well, I'm worried
right.
that you're not going to make it. Why are you going? He's like, well, I have a ticket and I have approval from the United States government. So I'm going. So he got on the airplane And then I got a message a number of hours later, and he said, "Hi, Mr. Joe, I'm in Taipei."
Mr. Joe.
And I sent him a big smile, you know, the icon, and said, "Wow, that's amazing." Then I didn't hear from him for, it had to have been over 12 hours. And then as the afternoon wore on, I was wondering how he was. And, you know, for a second, I felt physically ill. I was, you know, I had to lie down for a bit because I was just so worried about what would happen to him.
Come on. He's wearing the same tie. Sammy?
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. Where are you?
Yeah, I'm in now.
And?
I'm in America now, yeah.
Yeah.
He's in America. Next week, how did Sammy get here, and what happens to him now? We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Here's what else you need to know today. The next health secretary, Congressman Tom Price, has pushed for legislation that would benefit healthcare companies he's invested in. Senior White House advisor Kellyanne Conway went on cable news after Nordstrom dropped the first daughter's clothing line.
This is just, it's a wonderful line. I own some of it. I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today, everybody. You can find it online.
All right.
That endorsement appears to have violated federal ethics law, which prohibits presidential aides from endorsing a product. And it drew a gentle reprimand from Conway's colleague, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer.
Kellyanne has been counseled, and that's all we're going to go with. She's been counseled on that subject, and that's it.
And today, we end with your voicemails. Last week, on the first episode of this show, we asked you a question. Based on the times we're living through right now, when was the first time you felt like your life was intersecting with history?
The first time that I felt that my life was intersecting with history was when I was 13 and watched the nightly television broadcast from outside the Democratic Convention in Chicago. Seeing on TV people involved in peaceful demonstrations being beaten by police. Watching a TV cameraman get beaten and his camera filming the sidewalk as he fell to the ground. That experience politicized me, and I became instantly aware and needing to be involved in my country and its government, and I have been ever since.
I was 17. I was senior in high school, and I was pregnant. I walked into my third period class.
It doesn't appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
As a class, we watched in horror as both towers fell to the ground.
We just saw on live television as a second plane flew into the second tower of the World Trade Center.
It was a very scary and uncertain time. My son was born in March of 2002 and has never lived a day in his life when his country was not at war.
definitely the first time I felt as if my life was intersecting history was a little over more than a year ago.
Our nation was founded on a bedrock principle that we are all created equal.
When the Supreme Court ruled.
This morning, the Supreme Court recognized that the Constitution guarantees marriage equality.
And I was able to marry my partner of 30 years.
In doing so, they've reaffirmed that all Americans are entitled to the equal protection of the law.
I suddenly felt like I was a full citizen of the United States. And that was a feeling that I didn't really know that I hadn't had before. Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed your first show. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Thanks to all of you who called and emailed us with your stories. Today, a new question for this moment. How has immigration impacted your life? For me, it's my great-grandparents, Isidore and Gussie Rosenberg, who left Poland to become U.S. citizens in 1933 and 1935. By 1939, Hitler had invaded Poland. To share your story, call us and leave us a message, 30 seconds or less, at 804-991-0018. Don't forget to tell us your name and where you live. The Daily is produced by the small but mighty team of Theo Balcom, Andy Mills, and Lisa Tobin, with support from Sam Dolnick. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Pedro Rosado is our studio manager. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you on Monday.